And it's Friday here at the Damage Report. Last show of the week, always an exciting time, particularly with big Friday news dumps, which we're gonna be getting to in just a little bit. It is Friday though, so Brett Ehrlich, host of the Happy Half Hour, is here.
Yeah, I'm wearing sweaters now. It's
He's a
highly
sweater
contested
guy.
Issue around the office where I have to up my game in terms of what I wear, and I'm not happy about it.
No.
But I do comply because I like money.
Well, the funny thing is, if someone asked, is Brett a sweater guy, I would have said yes.
Everyone around the office, since it's been rainy in Los Angeles, has just demonstrated how much better their sweater game is than me.
Mm-hmm.
Sophie had a better sweater. Asher, better sweater. Our guest on yesterday's show, the longtime contributor to the Journal, to the Nation, had the best sweater I've ever seen. Go back and watch it. It was amazing.
Okay, well, you know, watch it either for the sweater or for an analysis of accounting fraud in the Pentagon. We've got some sweaters in the control room right now. We also have a packed show. This is one of those days where we have way too much. Someone is brandishing a hammer at us.
Because I think Jacori wants credit for a pink hoodie, which is not a sweater.
Okay, well, when we get to hoodies, we'll talk about that. We're not ready. Put down your hammer, people. Okay, so we do have a lot today. Way too much, couldn't fit everything we want to. Partly because we have two awesome guests today. So a little bit later on the show, we're gonna be joined by Ryan Lewis, expert on marijuana, to respond to Fox and Friends telling you that marijuana gummies are gonna kill you and everyone you love. Is that true? Maybe he'll say yes. Tune in and find out. And later on the show, Jason Stanley, a Yale philosopher, author of How Fascism Works, is gonna presumably explain how fascism works to us. And I'm gonna ask him a question. Is Donald Trump a fascist? We'll see what he thinks. Yale philosopher, smart guy, far smarter than me. Let's find out a little bit later on. Along the way, big news, Kevin Hart stepping down from hosting the Oscars. That's how we're gonna close out the week. We always try to go with something a little bit less explicitly political. So we'll have that at the close of the show. Two Democratic senators have an amazing proposal, an anti-corruption measure for senators. So they are gonna regulate themselves if this gets passed, and more, of course. So why don't we jump into the big news of the morning. As previewed yesterday, Donald Trump did in fact nominate William Barr as his next attorney general. That is big news because of some, not only his political history, obviously, which we'll get into, but some of the stances he's taken that could directly impact what sort of attorney general he would be in relation to the ongoing investigations into Donald Trump. So first, Barr formerly served as President George H.W. Bush's attorney general. Will be replacing former Attorney General Jeff Sessions if the Republican-controlled Senate approves the nomination. And they have generally not proven themselves to be hesitant to go along with Donald Trump on things like this. I have a feeling that if he gets nominated, he will get into the position, regardless of whatever opposition we throw up in videos like this.
Yes, the quote from Donald Trump is, "He was my first choice from day one," which I'm pretty sure day one for Donald Trump was the day of the Bush funeral.
I think so.
Where he was like, oh, I guess I do. And then someone probably just pulled him aside and was like, this is William Barr. He's been attorney general before. He has one nice thing he said about you in regards to the Mueller investigation.
Yeah.
Is that enough? And Trump said, yeah, sure.
Yeah, after having trailed off. He didn't pay attention to the second half of that, but he liked the first half.
Nice thing about you.
So let's talk about Barr. What does Barr actually think? What effect did he have back when he was the attorney general? What impact could he have as the attorney general now? Well, a couple important things getting into what Brett was talking about. In November 2017, Barr told the New York Times that there was actually more basis to investigate Hillary Clinton for the Uranium One deal than there is to investigate Trump for potential collusion with Russia. He went so far as to say the Justice Department was wrong to give Clinton a pass. That is one of several things that he thinks merit investigation of Hillary Clinton. And he apparently does not find it problematic in any way that Donald Trump regularly accuses his political opponents of treason and says that they should be investigated. If you're not familiar with the Uranium One deal, it's because you only consume legitimate news. It's a right-wing conspiracy theory that Hillary Clinton was giving away all of our nuclear materials to Russia or something like that. It has fallen out of vogue since last year, but it was a big thing for Sean Hannity and Tucker Carlson for a short period of time.
Yeah, and that's the priority right there that Trump has, is to have someone who says something that's remotely familiar to the kind of thing he would tweet.
Mm-hmm.
And the kind of thing he would tweet is, what about the Uranium One? And this guy has said it. Whether he said it recently, whether he still stands by it, I don't think Trump probably put enough due diligence in to figure it out. Trump did do something that is a part of the swamp and has been for decades, which is to float the idea in his appearance outside the White House today or yesterday, he essentially said, yes, I will be nominating this person. And the reaction that I had when I first announced I might was good. And so he floats it. He floats it in a different way. I think most people float it to see if there's going to be some kind of realistic pushback from Congress or others. But in this situation, he floats it to see if there's pushback from the right or wrong kind of people.
Yeah.
And it seemed like there wasn't much pushback from anyone, really.
Yeah, I guess Fox and Friends is in favor of it.
Yeah.
So we go ahead.
I defend Fox Friends.
Additionally, on that investigation, not the uranium one, but one that's going on right now. In a Washington Post op-ed, Barr said that Trump not only did nothing wrong in firing James Comey, but that he actually, quote, made the right call. And that, of course, was the genesis of this entire investigation, or at least the special counsel version of it, not House and Senate. So significant. By the way, on special counsels, when Bush, this is former president, George H.W. Bush in 1992, decided to pardon several figures in the Iran-Contra scandal, Barr took the legs out from beneath the independent prosecutor investigating the matter. At the time, the prosecutor, Lawrence Walsh, called it a sort of Saturday night massacre, a reference to high profile President Richard M. Nixon's firings during the thick of the Watergate scandal. So there had been this special counsel that was going to be looking into those pardons, and he took away much of the power for them to be able to do that. That was, you know, it's not something that gets talked about very often, but back at the time was a massive presidential scandal. So significant there too.
Yeah, underscores every bit of his priority list. Yeah. And that's it.
Yeah, now look, outside of that, there's concerns about what he would do, you know, as Attorney General. Attorney General, very important position. It has been, I mean, the view of it over the past couple of years, I think, has obviously been very focused on the Jeff Sessions taking himself out of, recusing himself from the investigation.
Yes.
But of course, he has a full-time job that he is doing. You're in charge of the Justice Department. It's extremely important, and Barr should worry you in his capacity in that job. In 1992, he signed off on a book by the Department of Justice titled The Case for More Incarceration. He also called on the country to build more jails and prisons.
I had not heard that at this point.
Isn't that amazing?
It just seems like Onion articles. It seems like fake things. Like,
no.
What else?
Well, also, they might be, but.
Also, he wrote Lock Her Up 100 times on his on a bathroom stall once.
Yeah.
That is perfect. These are the details that I think will come out next in your segment.
Well, no, we found one of his trapper keepers and it had no collusion and whiteout written on it. No, but look, that's really worrisome, especially because if you look at incarcerations over time, I mean, obviously we are a state that incarcerates a lot of people, but it started to drastically go up during the 90s. Like, it was people like him that led to this like pro lock everyone up position that the Justice Department has largely taken.
Yeah, H.W. was vice president to Reagan and just say no, war on drugs. It escalates, and that's really what got us to the levels of incarceration that we have right now. Go ahead.
I was gonna say, if we want to talk about drugs, he had something interesting to say about that. In 1992, Barr was asked about racial disparities in prisons by LA Times reporter Ronald Ostrow. Barr argued that, quote, our system is fair and does not treat people differently. Then he went on to defend laws that made prison sentences for crack cocaine much harsher than prison sentences for powder cocaine. So maybe he believes that, maybe he doesn't. But he was helping to uphold a system that explicitly on racial grounds criminalizes certain types of behavior rather than others. Not on the severity of the act or, you know, the damage that the crime does, but based on who is doing the crime.
I honestly don't think that it went any deeper though. You've provided a lot of evidence that this is the match made in heaven for Donald Trump and an attorney general. It has the stance on drugs that that Sessions had and all the other things, but I really do believe that the only problem that Donald Trump had with Jeff Sessions was that Jeff Sessions recused himself from any involvement in the Russia investigation. It spawned Mueller, and when he sought someone to replace Sessions, his single and only priority was to have someone who was on the record saying that something, something Hillary, something, something, back off when it comes to Russia. Yeah.
Well, then I have an interesting little thing from you, because right in advance of us going live, the New York Times has a new report about how Trump communicated with Barr about the possibility of him becoming the AG. And they had conversations, and we don't have a graphic of this, I apologize. In some of those conversations, Mr. Trump repeatedly asked whether the next pick would recuse himself from overseeing the special counsel investigation into whether his campaign conspired with Russia in its interference in the 2016 election, according to several people familiar with the search.
And there was a little box
explicitly
at the bottom
asking
that said check yes or no.
Exactly. That's simple. You don't have to read too much. So that very much was on his mind. So that was just one of several nominations to important positions. Hopefully we'll be able to cover more in the near future. We do have to take our first break. When we come back, Pot Expert joins the show to talk about marijuana gummies. Are they actually going to kill you, as Fox and Friends says, or can you afford to have one from time to time? We'll break that down after this. Despite more and more legalization of marijuana around the country over the past few years, the fear-mongering around marijuana continues. And joining the show now to help break down what is actually going on, what should you be concerned about, what is safe, we have investor and expert in CBD production and chief operating officer of Global Cannabinoids Inc., Ryan Lewis. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
Very glad to have you here. So the reason we wanted someone with your expertise on the show is because I saw a segment on Fox and Friends where they had a sheriff in Florida on talking about how marijuana gummies were killing people around the country every single day. And that scared me to my core. So I want to know the truth. When it comes to these sorts of things, how many people have died, have overdosed from marijuana consumption?
You know, I think I just saw a statistic yesterday that lettuce has killed more people than marijuana. And the reality is, it's, you know, the fear mongering is just really carryover from, you know, decades and decades of, you know, this prohibition mindset. The reality is that THC, the psychoactive compound found in marijuana, is the only psychoactive compound found in marijuana. You know, there's hundreds of medicinally beneficial compounds. And as more and more research is conducted, we're starting to learn about the health benefits that these other compounds have. You know, CBD being one of them, and the most abundant cannabinoid found in hemp, is completely non-psychoactive, has, you know, tremendous health benefits for pain, for stress, for anxiety, for sleep. And so as more and more research is conducted, we're learning about this plant and its many uses. And again, THC is only one compound. And like I said, lettuce has killed more people than cannabis. Mm-hmm. So,
you know, it's interesting that you bring that up, because I believe it was Brian Kilmeade. He said that he found it to be hypocritical that people who advocate for marijuana are, on the one hand, talking about its medicinal use in a variety of different areas. They want people to have access to it for that. But then they're also marketing it for recreation or for fun. Do you see anything hypocritical in that?
Well, I do believe that THC is a powerful compound, but if it's used correctly, it's very, you know, beneficial, and it has its place as a medicine in society. I think it should be regulated the same as alcohol. You know, but look no further than the alcohol industry and the damage that has caused. Look at what tobacco's done. Both of those are highly addictive. And so, you know, the truth of the matter is that yes, THC should be regulated much in the same way as alcohol, as tobacco. But again, there's so many different parts of this plant that are so useful to society and can really replace a vast amount of the pharmaceuticals that people are taking. Look no further than the side effects that they read on most of these commonly prescribed pharmaceutical drugs. I mean, they have drugs now for the side effects of the drugs that people are taking. And the reality here is that there's very minimal side effects associated with marijuana. You know, it makes you hungry. It makes you tired. I mean, mm-hmm. it gives you dry eyes.
Yeah. And of course, alcohol makes a lot of people tired as well. And we should point out that many, many people die every year from alcohol consumption, including, you know, auto wrecks and things like that. And lung cancer, despite decades of advocacy about anti-smoking, is still the leading killer when it comes to cancer. So the risks on the other side are not the sort of hypotheticals where we can go looking to try to find one person who is overdosed on marijuana. It is happening in every city across the country every single day. There was another thing that was brought up, though. I thought that we had sort of gotten past this idea, but two of the hosts on Fox and Friends were talking about how one of the reasons we should be worried about marijuana is that it is still, in this day, a gateway drug. And the sheriff agreed and said that very often people who smoke meth started by smoking marijuana. Is that a concern that we should have?
I think it's actually completely ridiculous. I mean, they're comparing basically a synthetic compound, a synthetic drug, and those effects to a medicinal plant that has been a part of, you know, of mankind since the beginning. The plant has so many different uses. You know, the notion that it's a gateway drug, especially when you compare it to alcohol and tobacco, I think is just absurd. And so to that, I would say we should regulate it exactly the way alcohol and tobacco is regulated.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting because I'm sort of joking about some of these old like reefer madness style things that they're spreading on Fox and Friends. But I also don't pretend that they're actually representative of what most Americans think about marijuana. You're in this industry. How much progress do you think that there's been over the last decade or two in educating people about the dangers of marijuana versus how it's portrayed, the gateway drug myth and all of that? Are people starting to get a little bit wiser to the actual risks and benefits?
I think they are. You know, the reality is that as more and more research is conducted and we learn that, you know, you can have extracts from the plant where the THC has been completely removed, you know, and there's other components of the plant like CBG, cannabigerol, cannabichromene, CBC. You know, there's so much attention placed on THC. Again, THC is the only psychoactive compound in the plant. You know, when we remove that from the extract, it's a whole different conversation. Completely different. So there's so many benefits to the plant, and as more and more research comes out about it, you know, it's just going to dispel a lot of the fear mongering and a lot of the misinformation that's been, you know, kind of planted in our minds over decades and decades of prohibition. You know, alcohol was went through a period of prohibition, and then look where we're at now. And so I just, again, you know, I say that cannabis and all of the benefits of the plant as it becomes more and more research is going to be, a lot of the fears are going to be, you know, basically dispelled.
I certainly hope so. Ryan Lewis, thank you for joining us on the show and helping break all this down.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. We're going to take a short break. We come back, move to stop some of the corruption in the Senate when it comes to stock trading after this. Welcome back to The Damage Report, everybody. Brett's joining me today, and lots to get to, so I'm going to jump right back into it. Two leading Senate Democrats have introduced a bill that would drastically change the relationship between elected officials and the ability to engage in stock trading, an ability that they've had up until now that has led to some criminal behavior. So under the measure unveiled on Thursday, current members could sell their stock holdings within 6 months after the bill's passing, and new members could sell holdings within 6 months of being elected. But once that period is over, no more trading stocks that can in any way be tied back to their lawmaking, which is extreme in the context of the conversation that had been going on in DC, but also seems like they were able to do that. They were able to trade stocks in industries that they're legislating on, which conceivably for a senator could involve every industry, but they were actually able to do that. They're still able to do that.
Right now,
that seems crazy.
There is a de facto special exemption because they have access to certain classified information, and they are able to create beneficial situations for certain industries over others. That is the classic regulation, deregulation, whatever you want to call it, debate. And so we lock up poor Martha Stewart for insider trading, and she just got a tip.
Yeah,
she isn't tipping the scales like a lawmaker could.
Yeah, they could. They're involved in some cases investigating particular companies.
Yeah,
and or not investigating those companies.
Mm-hmm, for sure, all those reasons that people have such a low approval rating with not necessarily their own personal congressperson, but definitely the concept of Congress. Mm-hmm. People totally understand that we have a representative democracy. However, when they think Congress, they think crap like this.
Yeah.
And it really pisses them off to the point where Congress has somewhere between typically like a 9% and 19% approval rating.
Yeah.
This is precisely what polls like that tap into, and it's very frustrating. And the counter argument is, well, without the ability to trade in the stock market, the ability to trade in the stock market gives them an incentive to make sure that the stock market is healthy. No, a healthy economy is the only motivation they're gonna need, and bringing back money not to their own personal pocketbooks, but to the people who vote for them in their region. There's enough of that. You know, there's enough pork going around where, you know, it ends up yielding some kind of perception of corruption because they're trying to bring pork back to their constituencies. In this situation, we're trying to eliminate the element of that incentivizes them to bring money back to their own wallets at the expense of their constituencies.
Yeah. Now, I want to give credit to the two senators who are pushing this. This is Senators Merkley and Brown, two of the more progressive senators across the country. Merkley said it's way past time to end conflicted trading in which legislators and top staff trade in stocks while making decisions affecting their value. Again, seems like literally the most reasonable thing I've heard in months. And Sherrod Brown says elected officials have access to non-public information that can affect individual companies and entire industries. There must be more accountability and transparency to prevent members from using this information and abusing their positions for personal gain. I mean, would they do that? Would they manipulate legislation to benefit themselves? Yes, they would, and they have. Earlier this year, Representative Chris Collins, Republican of New York, was indicted on insider trading charges in August after he allegedly told his son about a failed drug trial at Australian company Innate Immunotherapeutics before it was announced. His son and son's fiance then sold their shares in the company, avoiding roughly $768,000 in losses. Despite the charges, Collins won his bid for re-election in November. As part of at least several examples in this year that the Law and Order Party has voters who don't care at all about breaking the law.
Let's yes.
That's Duncan Hunter Jr.
Right, for sure. Because I think people don't start necessarily with what makes sense. They start with what they want and then warp reality to achieve what they want.
Yeah.
And sometimes what they want is just not to lose an argument.
Yeah.
And sometimes not losing an argument means voting for a racist.
That's true. So look, this is in the Senate, which the Democrats don't have control of. So as with every good bill we talk about for the next 2 years, it probably isn't going to pass. But it is still a good thing to push for a number of different reasons. And I also want to give credit to Elizabeth Warren. So this bill would stop them from trading stocks. But back in August, Elizabeth Warren had a bill that would ban members of Congress and White House staff from owning individual stocks, which I think it might be a little bit more complicated, but I prefer that honestly, because senators, sure, that senators are an issue if they're using insider trading effectively, but I also think representatives and members of the White House staff as well. If they're setting policies, if they're doing executive orders, that could, I mean, they're literally leading the departments that regulate these industries. So they should totally do it as well. The head of the EPA should not be holding stocks that have to do with companies that generate electricity and pollution and things like that.
Or an indexed blind fund, you know, blind trust that allows that is tied back to the general health of the economy, even though it can be argued.
Which they would still be able to have.
But that a beneficial healthy stock market isn't necessarily reflective of an economy that works in the best interests of voters and normal human beings.
Agreed. And they would still be able to have that, just not individual stocks. I think that is a great system. I would prefer that quite a bit. Let's turn now to something else. Tucker Carlson is obviously seen, I think, as a strong supporter of the president. I mean, he's a host on Fox News. There was some question early on in the primary, the last time around, about some supported Donald Trump, some supported other candidates. But since the election, they've very much been in his corner. But in a recent interview, Tucker Carlson seemed more willing to criticize the president than I have seen from anyone like him in quite some time. So let's go through some of the quotes from this interview. He was asked, do you think he has kept his promises? Has he achieved his goals? And Tucker Carlson said no. That's blunt. Look, Sean Hannity was not gonna give that answer, okay? Yeah. Just like, let's keep it real. Now, he did explain what he meant, and it isn't as strong in the end as it seems, but let's give you some of what he said. I've come to believe that Trump's role is not as a conventional president who promises to get certain things achieved to the Congress and then does. I don't think he's capable. I don't think he's capable of sustained focus. I don't think he understands the system. I don't think the Congress is on his side. I don't think his own agencies support him. He's not going to do that. I think Trump's role is to begin the conversation about what actually matters. So there's certainly some criticism there. He's not capable of sustained focus. Is effectively he has no attention span. But then there's also there's a bit of the deep state in the agencies not supporting him, saying Congress doesn't support him. Kind of, in some ways, but I think that largely they've given him what he has asked for that is at least reasonable that you could get some Democrats on board. But he is saying that he's not capable and hasn't kept his promises.
That part where he says, I think Trump's role is to begin the conversation about what actually matters, that is Carlson's angle.
Yeah.
His angle is to say, listen, I'm an economic populist. Who is still all about?
Well, he says in the interview that he is explicitly speaking out against populism.
Yeah, but he has this whole. I mean, he backs Bernie Sanders when he talks, and he talks about Bezos and people who are taking government subsidies and underpaying workers. That is his version
That's true.
Economic populism. But it's weird with Tucker Carlson when you take like a bit of an interview from him. He talks in such weird. Like rhetorical arcs that last for a long time before he then says, but, and changes completely. The beginning of that but is the part where he says Trump's role is to begin the conversation about what actually matters. And that is in his mind when he's trying to guide Trump from his bully pulpit at Fox News is to point out things like the Stop Bezos Act.
Yeah, yeah, and I understand that, but that is very, that is his position as this weird elite conservative, like you sort of described. That's not what the average Trump supporter wants out of Trump. To begin a long conversation of what's really important. They want a wall and they want Mexico to pay for it and they want it to be paid for now. So there is a divide there. He was asked, apart from asking these very important questions, has he really achieved nothing? And Tucker Carlson says, not much, not much, much less than he should have. I've come to believe he's not capable of it. But which is great. That's criticism. Good. I like to see some criticism coming from a Fox News host. But then let's criticize Tucker Carlson a little bit because he also said this is an amazing quote. One of my favorite quotes in the last quarter or so. I'm not against an aristocratic system. I'm not against a ruling class. I think that hierarchies are natural. People create them in every society. Wow. You're not against a ruling class. Just let's say, not pragmatic, rhetorically, that should be your first draft. You gotta go over that a few times and come up with a way of, like his Fox viewers are not all heirs like he is. They didn't inherit a fortune like Tucker Carlson did. That should turn off his viewers. It won't because we live in a crazy world, but it certainly should. I'm not against an aristocratic system. I'm not against a man rolling down the boulevard in his carriage and occasionally chucking a gold coin to an urchin. I'm not against that.
It's just so Tucker. It's like.
He also says this. I just think the system that we have now is the meritocracy, which is based really on our education system.
Which is the opposite of what you just said. But again, he's right. I said this to you before. It's like there is a meritocracy. There's a version of a meritocracy that you have, but it doesn't apply to most of the people that Tucker hangs around with. There's a sport. There's multiple sports that we follow in popular culture. There's the sport of the meritocracy, which not a lot of people get to play. And then the sport that he is in, which is the elite sport, and the uniform is that blazer buttoned down pocket square combo with the poofy hair.
Yeah, and the continued desire to wear bow ties, even if you've been shamed out of it. Yeah, so look, good that he criticized Trump, I'll give him credit for that. But remember that he's a fundamentally disingenuous person who says that he tells the truth, but everything that he says is a lie in advance of a political ideology, or in pursuit of a political ideology, I should say. We have a meritocracy based on our education system. Our education system almost could not be less of a meritocracy. Yes, we have universal lower education, but which schools you go to, that is gonna strongly influence the outcomes you have. Your ability to get into these great colleges, sure, if you're on a legacy system, if your father owned Swanson or something like that, you're probably gonna do quite well. And maybe you also worked, I'm not saying you didn't work, but the idea that our education system is just this blind meritocracy is absolutely absurd to everyone who didn't grow up in a gated community.
Yeah.
That's my point.
Remember that SAT question about yachting?
It was tough.
It was real.
It was tough. I don't know all those knots. I just don't. Okay, that said, we're gonna take a short break. When we come back, Jason Stanley is gonna be with us. Yale philosopher, author of How Fascism Works. Fascinating conversation ahead. You've probably heard fascism talked about quite a lot in this country over the past few years, but here at the Damage Report, when possible, we like to turn to the experts. So I am very excited to welcome to the show Jason Stanley, Yale philosopher and author of How Fascism Works. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
Very glad to have you on, hoping to learn a lot. So as I alluded to, many people talk about fascism. They often seem to be speaking past each other and defining it in very different ways. To you, how would you define fascism?
So fascism is an ideology based on power, loyalty, and fear of the other. It's best to think about Hitler's book. It's called My Struggle. And what's meant by that is that life is a struggle, and life defines a hierarchy based on power. So liberal democracy is based on equality and liberty. The fascist denies equality and they deny liberty. They say that nature demands a hierarchy. So fascists always speak about a hierarchy. Fascists say that life is ordered in a hierarchy of groups. And the people highest on the hierarchy have won by struggle, by a meritocratic struggle. And as a result, they have more value in the system. Liberal democracy says we all have equal value. We have equal value because we're all human beings and we have dignity. Fascist ideology says that that's incompatible with nature. In every society, there is a hierarchy, naturally orders itself into a hierarchy. The hierarchy is ordered by a meritocratic struggle. So fascists will talk about those two virtues, and they will say that groups are ordered on the basis of how they succeed in that struggle. And so the group that's on top of the hierarchy, be it whites, be it Christians, be it Muslims, Jews, Hindus, whatever your favorite race or ethnicity is, they've won by this meritocratic struggle and they've earned their position at the top of the hierarchy. So fascism orders society along a hierarchy via a struggle. Value is gained not just by being human, but by winning in a struggle. And those who don't win in that struggle are losers and have no value. And loyalty replaces truth. Because loyalty to your group is what enables victory and struggle.
Okay, so I already feel bad that I didn't book you for the full hour because I would like to follow up on almost everything that you said there. Very fascinating. We were just talking actually about an interview that Tucker Carlson did, and he echoed some of what you said there about how hierarchies are natural. It's not bad that we should have a ruling class in this country. So do you think that some of the punditry might be either unknowingly or perhaps knowingly echoing some of the sentiments that you've expressed?
I think we hear fascist ideology all around us. It's part fascism is kind of an extreme of certain kinds of right-wing ideology that one hears. I mean, libertarianism is definitely not fascism because the consistent libertarian denies that groups have more value. The consistent libertarian says, oh, an individual has more value if they win in the free market struggle. And the only thing that matters is struggle in a free market, and the loser has no value. But the libertarian is definitely not a fascist because they stop at the level of the individual. The fascist ideology moves that social Darwinist view of libertarianism from the individual to the group. And says that certain groups, it's natural that certain groups succeed more in the struggle, in the meritocratic struggle, and therefore have more value. And that's something we see that move from the non-fascist libertarian position to the fascist view that certain groups are rightfully have more merit, should have more power, should have more value. We see that slip all the time in American politics.
So I feel like I have to ask the question then. You've been observing over the past few years, we have a president, Donald Trump. Is he a fascist?
I think that there's no question that his base ideology is fascist, that he talks of winners and losers. He talks of, he talks of nationalism. You used to have dynasties in the 19th century. This moved to nationalism where where the idea was one individual alone is not enough to face the challenges. We need to struggle as nations, where nations are defined in terms of ethnicity and common ethnicity and a common language. We have explicit, Mr. Trump is giving us explicit tropes of European fascism. He's talking about globalists versus nationalists. These are explicit tropes. He already, before he appropriated this vocabulary of globalism versus nationalism, which directly reflects things in the European far right in books like Guillaume Fay's Why We Fight, he was before that just sort of a natural fascist, if you will. He is a very skilled rhetorician. He openly lies. The open lying is a key part of fascism, of fascist politics, because in fascist politics, you're trying to demonstrate your power. It's all about winning, right? It's all about winning and dominating the game. So meritocracy, it's all like a fight to win, and the winners have all the value. And so truth has no value. Truth is the way you level out. Truth is at the core of equality. It's how you level out the distinction between people with more power. So Mr. Trump lied and showed that he could get away with his lies, thereby showing his power. So I think there's not only in his tactics was he engaging in fascist tactics, in his ideology that it's all about winning and losing and he doesn't like losers, but now he's explicitly taken over tropes from the European far right, like nationalism versus globalism, the toxic anti-immigration rhetoric. And don't forget, Steve Bannon explicitly endorsed Camp of the Saints, a book that ends with a European fascist book.
Fascinating. I wish that we had more time. Hopefully in the near future, if you'd be willing to come back on, I'd like to talk to you about some of those other international examples that you brought up. And also get if you have any advice on what we can do as a population to fight back. So hopefully we can do that in the near future.
That would be great. That's, of course, the big question.
And Jason, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll be back in just a bit more. We have a little bit more to close out the week for you. Welcome back to the show, everybody. We have only minutes remaining in this week, so let's turn to something a little bit lighter. Kevin Hart has announced that he, in fact, will not be hosting the next Academy Awards, just days after the announcement that he would be hosting it. And it has to do with the scandal involving some of his past tweets and concern about that. We're gonna break down different aspects of this. But first, here's his announcement from Twitter. "I've made the choice to step down from hosting this year's Oscars. This is because I do not want to be a distraction on a night that should be celebrated by so many amazing, talented artists. I sincerely apologize to the LGBTQ community for my insensitive words from my past. I'm sorry that I hurt people. I am evolving and want to continue to do so. My goal is to bring people together, not tear us apart. Much love and appreciation to the Academy. I hope we can meet again." So, I mean, he's alluding to these past comments. That is what the scandal's been about. We're gonna read just a few of the things that people had an issue with. He had previously said in 2011, "Yo, if my son comes home and tries to play with my daughter's dollhouse, I'm going to break it over his head and say in my voice, stop, that's gay." He said in Seriously Funny, one of his comedy specials, "One of my biggest fears is my son growing up and being gay. That's a fear. Keep in mind, I'm not homophobic, be happy, do what you want to do. But for me, as a heterosexual male, if I can prevent my son from being gay, I will." Asked about that particular comment back in 2015, he said, "I wouldn't tell that joke today because when I said it, the times weren't as sensitive as they are now. I think we love to make big deals out of things that aren't necessarily big deals because we can." And in some of the sort of lead up to him announcing that he wouldn't be hosting it, there were some similar sentiments expressed about people being overly sensitive and saying that he had previously apologized for these comments.
Right. So I think I think that comedic angle about like being a straight man, being afraid that your kid's gonna be gay, and this weird instinct to like keep them from being gay, he definitely says like aloud. I think that's an interesting angle to start a comedic piece about. Mm-hmm. Because it's not about what's right and wrong in society, being gay versus not being gay. It's about this little moment that you have. And I think a lot of great comedy is about those little moments where you're like, oh my God, I'm a terrible person. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what that points to.
And he says in his apology of that joke, he says that's what the joke was. That it wasn't about his kid, it was about him. But I don't know.
It is.
That joke sounds very similar to a lot of what Louis C.K. says about his own insecurities and things like that. But in the original joke and in the apology, there's nothing that tells me that he doesn't think that you can't stop someone from being gay. Not that you shouldn't.
Yeah, but he doesn't.
He
need
seems
to
appear to think that it is a thing that can be stopped or can be allowed.
Yeah, but that appearance
which is a fundamental is not, ignorance.
He could add that. My default approach to that is maybe he does believe that, maybe he doesn't believe that. There's not enough information in that. And a better apology would be one that says, of course, I don't think you can stop someone from being gay. The way that I've seen that special and the way that I took away from it was not that what I took away from it was not that he believes you can stop someone from being gay. Mm-hmm. He's characterizing his mindset and this weird, ridiculously stupid instinct he has to believe that he can stop a kid from being gay when he knows well and good you can't.
Yeah, that may well could be. It didn't seem explicit to me in the apology that that's what it was. And obviously, we should point out that neither Brett nor I are perfectly placed to evaluate whether his apology rises to the level that the LGBT community shouldn't have a problem with it anymore.
I am.
No, we're not actually. No. And so, look, the interesting thing here is that he had previously said, I think on Instagram, that he's being asked to apologize and he doesn't want to because he already has. So he doesn't, and then he announces that he's not gonna host it and apologizes to the community.
So
he did apologize, he just did it after stepping down as opposed to before.
It's the wobble, and I think this is something that's not necessarily excusable, but at least we can identify what's happening. It's the apology wobble, which is what I call it, which is you realize in a moment, I need to apologize, it's the right thing to do, I'm doing it right. I'm putting it out there, tweet, go, apology, done. Mm-hmm. Then there's that moment afterwards where you think of one aspect of what you apologize for that you're not sorry about. Mm-hmm. And then you're like mad. And there is an Instagram video out there where he is in that stage of it. It's not excusable, it's not okay. I think it's universal that people have that moment where they get mad about having apologized, where they forget what they actually did wrong. It's this weird bargaining that happens in the process. But that's at least where he's at.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Look, it's interesting. I mean, there's been many instances like this where people have said, and Twitter is now an archive of generally the worst things that we've said. He says that he has learned since then, and it was some time ago. I mean, he wasn't, 12 when he posted those things, but people can learn and can change. The thing is, I think, what if back in 2007, I had posted some tweets that were really racist?
Yeah.
And then in 2011, I apologized for it. In 2018, could I be mad if people wanted me to apologize again? I don't think so. I don't think I can be like, no, I addressed that. I think, look,
yeah,
you can
you
learn, you can learn and you can grow. You certainly can. But it's not up to you as the individual to say that you're not allowed to have concerns. And this has nothing to do with whether or not I think he should be hosting or not. It's just about apologies in the culture that we have right now. If I said racist things and then said that I had grown, I think it's perfectly legitimate for you to continue to question that and just want me to sincerely address it when necessary.
Right. There are certain things for which you need to apologize every time they come up for the rest of your life. And the person who is asking you to apologize again is not losing the moral high ground here. They still have it because you were the jerk.
Yeah. And look, it is certainly, I agree, it's inconvenient to have to apologize multiple times, but it's not as inconvenient as being a member of this community that has been brutalized and mocked for literally the entire time we've had humans.
And more on this.
And that is not on Kevin Hart, obviously, but that is a thing that it exists in the context of.
More on this on the main show later today.
Exactly. There will be more conversation, which Brett will be hosting in the second hour. Brett, thank you for closing out the week with us.
Take
as always, thank you for watching. We will see you next week with lots more news for you.